Welcome to VOA's Now Show. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Lynn Young.
Today, we'll introduce you to a woman in New York who started a photo blog of couples from different ethnic backgrounds. Jenna Park lives in Brooklyn, and her blog is called The Mixed Race Project.
So I started questioning, you know, why aren't we seeing or celebrating the simple beauty in everyday life? You know, even if that means there's a clutter of mess in the kitchen.
Also, we'll hear how Asian Americans' views of themselves are changing.
We'll visit a D.C. school that is using music to help at-risk students stay out of trouble.
How can making a film change the lives of disabled people? We'll visit one studio that is doing just that.
Plus, would you ride in a car with no driver? Some folks in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania are. We'll tell you how, coming up on Now. Jenna Park grew up in New York City, where she said she never felt like she fit in. Her parents moved to the United States when Jenna was only three, and Jenna says her parents' ties to their home country of South Korea made fitting in difficult.
You kind of didn't want to be different. You just kind of wanted to be Americanized because you didn't want to get picked on. You didn't want to, you know, appear different from other people, even though it was a diverse city, you know, but I did get called names, you know, back then. I mean, that was kind of part of life back in the 70s in the city.
Jenna started studying art at Cooper Union College in New York, but left school and traveled the country. Eventually, she wound up in the Pacific Northwest, where she was studying music composition. That's also where she met her husband, Mark Sopchak.
The couple eventually moved back to New York, where Mark worked as a pastry chef, and Jenna went to graduate school and worked in graphic design. Her interest in photography also led Jenna to start a photo blog called The Mixed Race Project. She told us that she didn't see real people in most of the photo portraits she saw, and she wanted to change that.
Images and books that I did come across often focused on the face and on traditional portraiture. And ironically, you know, after a while, these portraits started feeling a bit homogenous because I didn't know anything. You know, these images didn't tell me anything about these people and their lives. So I started questioning, you know, why aren't we seeing or celebrating the simple beauty in everyday life? You know, even if that means there's a clutter of mess in the kitchen or a pile of shoes in the doorway, you know, there's simple beauty in that.
Jenna and Mark have two daughters, age 6 and 9. Jenna says that her daughters don't have the struggles she had at their age trying to fit in.
You know, they know that they're half Korean, but they just don't see that they're different, which is wonderful. You know, just we live in a community where there are a ton of mixed race kids and families. And so in their eyes, they're no different from anybody else in our community.
Mark Sopchak, who now runs his own bakery business in New York, says that being from different backgrounds brings richness to life, especially at mealtimes and holidays.
We go to Jenna's parents' house. There's a whole multitude of foods that you prepare and things that you do. And also at the same time, I'm thinking about what I do when I visit my family and see the Russian things that I used to do growing up and the mushroom soup that my grandmother used to make. And, you know, it's the little things like that that I think it means a lot to remember these things about, you know, your grandparents, and then you can pass them on to your kids.
Jenna and Mark spoke to us by Skype from New York.
And if you would like to see some of Jenna's work on the Mixed Race Project, or you'd like to read her blog, there's a link on our webpage, voanews.com. As Jenna Park mentioned, she, like many Asian Americans growing up in the United States in the 1970s, struggled to fit in.
But as Elizabeth Lee tells us from Los Angeles, there is a growing sense of Asian American pride and a unique cultural identity that has made it hip to be Asian in the U.S.
That would be all for you guys.
On any given evening, after 9 o'clock, college students and professionals pack the factory tea bar. It is more of a lounge filled with comfortable couches and soft lighting. But this bar serves no alcohol. There is only tea, sweetened, often served with ice, milk, and an import from Taiwan. Large, chewy tapioca balls called boba. College student Tiffany Porter is an American-born Chinese who comes here often.
The boba place is like unique to Asian people, and so if you want like that Asian comfort, you come to a boba place, and so that you can feel at home with a lot of like other Asian people.
Porter is what sociologist Oliver Wang calls the boba generation.
I think the boba generation, if you will, can span everything from today's teenagers up through people probably of my generation. I'm in my early 40s now.
Wang says that in the last 20 to 30 years, what it means to be Asian in Southern California has dramatically changed. When he was growing up here, he says Asian Americans saw themselves as invisible.
We were the honor students. We performed well academically, but we weren't necessarily at the top of the kind of internal cultural hierarchy that existed within schools or within a community. And I think that's been a huge shift in this area in the last 20 to 30 years.
Wang says this generation grew up seeing more Asian faces on television locally and through satellite. Asians are no longer stereotypes, and they now can see how other Asians portray themselves as trendy, like in this music video, Boba Life, by comedians The Fung Brothers. We don't even have to try, 'cause we're living Boba Life. David Fung says Boba is to the Asian American community what Coca-Cola is to the rest of America.
I know Boba is even more ubiquitous in Taiwan than here, but they don't have the same culture built around it.
The culture of boba cafes being trendy has been embraced by people from throughout Asia living in Southern California, including Indonesian-American Lina Yauri, who likes to socialize at boba cafes with her Indonesian friends.
We like relaxing, we like chatting, and then we like to enjoying the drink.
You want boba?
Chachawatprin Kemniam is from Thailand, but he knew boba teas have universal appeal. That's why he opened Factory Tea Bar, and he says business has been booming.
Boba has become life, become one of their life, like a part of their life.
And that lifestyle among Asian Americans is spreading across the U.S., says Andrew Fung of the Fung Brothers.
On every college campus, there's enough Asian people, there's enough Chinese people, there's enough Taiwanese people where they're going to have one boba shop, no matter how crappy it is, and all the Asians know about it.
Make it tasty, the new drink of all the young Asians. Make it tasty, you can call us the boba generation.
Boba cafes have become a symbol of a cultural movement among Americanized Asians who are still in touch with their ethnic identity, but also take pride in being uniquely Asian American. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles. Boba, drinking on boba, boba,
boba. Now, Lynn, I want to ask, have you tried boba? Are you part of the boba generation?
I would assume that I'm one of them because I love boba tea. That's the first, I think I learned of this term when I studied in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I learned about boba tea and I fell in love with it.
Now, of the folks from my part of the country would call it bubble tea, but mm-hmm. it's called boba, which is B-O-B-A. It's
yes.
not bubbles like bubbles in a bath.
I think it's exactly the same thing. It's just caught differently.
I first came across it in Vancouver when I was up there for the Olympics in 2010. There were people lined up in this, what they called a bubble tea shop. And
There's
I'm like, what is bubble tea? What do they carbonate it? And they said, no, it's got stuff in it.
Yep.
And I went,
There's a huge Asian community in Vancouver, so I assume there's a lot of them there. So,
I thought maybe it was a Canadian thing, but apparently it's not.
It is not. It's a very Asian thing, and I'm really glad it's gained a lot of popularity in America.
Mm-hmm.
I can definitely agree with this being hip to be Asian in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because I bet 20 years ago, no one is interested in anything about Asian culture, but today everybody is talking about it. All of my friends are asking me, like, what's the culture in China? What's the tradition? They love to learn.
And they
love to learn the language. If you'd like to comment on Elizabeth Lee's story, or if you have a story of your own to tell, you can find us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Coming up, we'll take you to a studio where disabled people are using the iPad to express themselves. U.S. inner-city schools are plagued by high dropout rates, crime-infested neighborhoods, and underfunded programs.
Kid Pan Alley, a creative nonprofit that conducts songwriting and workshops nationwide, recently visited a school in a tough Washington, D.C. district. VOA's Mark Snowis shows how the work boosts kids' creativity and self-confidence.
Listen, just me and Paul. One, two, three, four. Listen to the radio alone. Alone in my room, do it. Alone in my room. Yeah, okay.
Songwriter and recording artist Paul Reisler has worked with more than 35,000 students and produced over 2,200 songs since founding Kid Pan Alley in 1999. An influential musician who has performed widely since the 1970s, Reisler understands the transformative power of music.
We're living in a creative economy now. We're living in an economy that needs people who can imagine things and make things in their minds. You see, creativity is the most powerful thing there ever was. So what we're really doing is trying to inspire them to be creative.
Orr Elementary in Washington, D.C.'s Anacostian neighborhood is a high poverty school with 95% of its students coming from low-income families, well above the citywide average. Marlon Ray is an administrator at Orr.
We have, you know, kids that are homeless. We have kids that are, you know, going through various challenges in shelters and so forth. However, you know, those kids still want to strive for greatness.
Added to these stark realities, a drive-by shooting took place in April, right here, directly in front of Orr Elementary. Nearly 70 violent crimes and 200 property crimes have occurred within a kilometer of the school over the past year alone.
Sometimes we mention that, you know, we feel like students are going through war. They go home and they hear things, they see things, things that are a little scary. But in the midst of all of that, they still have to learn.
LaShayla, an Orr first grader, lives with her parents. Her grandmother, Lita Nimmons, also helps raise her.
What we teach our kids is always by the time the lights come on, it's time to come in the house.
Parents Juwan Eaton and Dwayne Curry say Orr staff face these challenges creatively and that Reisler's work meshes perfectly.
Orr tries to teach the positive, not the negative, so it's kind of, he fell right on in. So it was a good experience for the kids.
Who can sing the first line for me?
Back at the workshop, Reisler and collaborator Heather May encouraged the students to move beyond ideas coming from television.
I know nothing about TV. I've not had a TV since 1967.
What? Wow!
Eventually, first grader Paul plants a seed that develops into the song, I Heard It on the Radio.
You can write a song about anything that's not on TV. What would you write about?
Or the radio.
Or the radio. Although we could write about the radio.
So we can sing a song about the radio?
Yeah.
Kid Pan Alley has produced 3 commercial CDs, worked with big name artists, and received numerous awards and a Grammy nomination.
And so we've had people like Amy Grant and Delbert McClinton, Kix Brooks of Brooks and Dunn, Sissy Spacek, the very well-known American actress.
Ray says the week-long workshop and concert created positive memories that will last for years.
Our slogan here at Orr is whatever it takes. And that's for our staff. We have to do whatever it takes to make it happen.
Mark Snowis, VOA News, Washington.
If you'd like to see a video of some of the kids at Kid Pan Alley, log on to our website, voanews.com.
You're listening to Now on Voice of America.
Do you have an iPad? Do you use it for work, for play, or for fun?
How about if you wanted to make your own movie with it?
Faiza El-Masri and Faith Lapidus tell us now that the iPad's combination of high-definition video and simple touchscreen editing has opened new doors of creativity for people with disabilities.
More than a dozen people with physical and intellectual disabilities come to this daycare facility twice a week and turn into filmmakers. At the Creative Edge Filmmaking Workshop, they learn to use iPads to shoot and edit video.
It's just another program enhancement that we're trying to apply to all of our day programs moving forward.
Melissa Azell is a project director of the ARC. The nonprofit advocacy group provides services to the disabled and began offering the workshop earlier this year.
The philosophy of this partnership, the Creative Edge Digital Media Partnership, is to introduce iPads to our individuals with disability so they can use them as communication tools, but also as tools to creatively express themselves through photography or through iMovie.
The adults in this program are varied in their abilities. Most of them need the help of special facilitators like Judy Turay. She attends the workshop to help 30-year-old Nicole Chase, who is intellectually challenged.
She communicates so well with me. She likes taking pictures of her friends.
Program director Azell says although it's a relatively new program, the workshop is already benefiting the participants.
I think they're responding pretty well, really getting used to the idea of a touchpad and that your finger makes a decision directly on a screen. What we also see is that recognition of self and the idea of self-portraiture when people immediately use the iPads to take a photograph of themselves. Thirdly, the idea of sequencing and understanding past and present. So you record something in real time, then you replay it, and that's what happened a few minutes ago. And that is also a big cognitive leap for our individuals to learn.
Filmmaker Andrew Millington of the Creative Edge Studio taught the group the basics of image capturing, editing, and sequencing. Now, he encourages them to use those skills to create their own stories. 25-year-old Michael Steele brought his toys to the workshop, a bunny, a pig, a horse, two robots, and a plastic school bus. They are the characters in his movie.
We taught him to use sound effects. He began to sort of, he motorized the bus. He made the bus real. He put kids on the bus, so you heard the bus passing by and there was this loud giggle. Then, as we went on, I discovered that he had a grandmother who lived in New York. And he would apparently go to New York either by bus or he'd see children on the bus or he was part of the bus himself.
As these new filmmakers draw on their own experiences, they also develop their own style of storytelling.
All of us, being human, have language. Artistic language can be abstract, but once they find something that's unique to them, to their expression, they develop and they make up their own rules. It may not be the Hollywood strict form of expression, A follows B follows C, so on, but it's how he sees the world. It's how he chooses to express the world.
As a filmmaker, Millington admires his students' ability to explore and express themselves.
They pull from an imagination that is not obfuscated by daily life. They don't have the kind of intrusions and judgments into our storytelling. I wish I could tell a story with that freedom, with that purity of expression.
Filmmaking is part of the ARC's holistic approach to integrating people with intellectual and developmental disabilities into their community, explains Jessica Neely, its director of family services.
We have sort of three general areas: fitness, arts, and personal development.
The next step, she says, will be taking this group out with their iPads to document what they see.
The goal is to sort of move the whole model of an adult day center out from the four walls of the center and into the community, truly integrated within a larger community.
Andrew Millington has another goal for the films his students create.
I'm hoping that eventually the standard reaches a point where we can screen them for audiences.
That would introduce those audiences to the visions and talents of a community that is often unseen. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a
drive, do you love getting behind the wheel of your car, or is it a chore that you endure?
But what if your car could drive itself? Would you get in? Would you feel safe?
A team of researchers at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been working on developing a Cadillac SUV that drives itself. Raj Rajkumar is the co-director of a research lab at CMU. He says the autonomous car eliminates one of the biggest factors in crashes, human error.
Humans get distracted. About 93% of accidents in cars happen due to human error, right? People are distracted, they are maybe sleepy, angry, looking at something else, or even they may even be drunk.
The car Rajkumar and his team are developing uses computers, lasers, radars, cameras, and other tools to constantly monitor its environment and change course, speed, and even stop if it needs to.
Rajkumar says that taking human error out of driving will eliminate accidents caused by distracted drivers because the computer is always alert.
If you can basically take the human out of that equation, out of the driving equation, distractions will go away and computers will not get distracted. They're not human. So therefore, we can actually minimize those accidents, take those accidents slowly towards zero.
Several major car makers are hoping to offer driverless cars over the next few years. Google has been working on a prototype that has logged more than 300,000 miles on the roads.
The Carnegie Mellon SUV looks just like any other vehicle, but it uses wireless and GPS technology to navigate. Raj Rajkumar says the car's sense of awareness is far superior to anything that humans can do.
Suppose you are driving at night, the streetlights are off, and your headlights start blinking and they die for, well, just to take an extreme example. We as humans cannot perceive anymore, but if the car is outfitted with a thermal imaging camera, a heat sensing device, it can actually see that there is a human or an animal in front of the car. The computer can actually detect that and stop the car. We humans have not perceived the obstacle, but the computer has.
One thing that might delay autonomous cars is the cost. Google's car costs $150,000 per vehicle, and about half that goes to laser rangefinder, the car used to orient itself.
And there's also the law to get passed. The U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says the cars need more safety-related improvements before they can be allowed on the roads. Now, Lynn, I want to ask you, would you get in a driverless car?
I mean, I'm wholeheartedly welcome this change in the world.
Really?
I mean, driverless cars, here I come. If there is one, I'm going to buy one, no matter
really?
The cost.
Because
me, no sense of direction, no sense of distance. I mean, my car is all scratches. If I can get someone to drive my car, I mean, the computers is always more alert than human.
Yeah. And you don't do like text and drive and stuff like
no,
that.
No, I don't
really
do
dangerous.
That. I don't do that. It's just I have a bad sense of direction. So
well,
I'm always,
you know, well, the thing is, there have been some cars that will park themselves, you know, like Lexus
I've seen
and some
those,
others.
Yes. Hey,
you know, you pull up to a parallel parking slot and it actually will pull itself into the parking spot. But I don't know. I feel a little leery because while my car might be driverless, all the other cars on the road aren't.
Exactly.
And somebody out there who's not paying attention can ram into my driverless car, even if it stops.
Especially if you're in a city like New York City or Washington, D.C., where the traffic is just crazy.
The Beltway is notorious.
Exactly. There are so many circles. There are so many second right turns. You never know what to do, even by yourself. I don't know about the computer. Maybe it can beat us.
Well, we'll see, because this is in development, and they do hope within the next few years to have these things actually traveling on the highway.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think? Are driverless cars in your future? Let us know your opinion by logging onto our website, www.voanews.com.
Or you can send us a tweet. Our address on Twitter is @NowVOAShow. Thanks for joining us for Now. I'm David Burke.
And I'm Lynn Young.
And we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email with your questions or comments by addressing it to voaasia@voanews.com.
And don't forget social media. Send us a tweet. Our address is @NowVOAShow.
The producer of Now is Patrice Martin. The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gell. Coming up on the next Now program, she was out of a job in New York, but she accomplished her dream by becoming a private investigator. Meet Cece McNair, who investigated some of the most dangerous criminals in the Big Apple, on our next Now show.